You're listening to the Blue Ridge True Crime Podcast, bringing you compelling true crime stories from the Appalachian Mountains and beyond. I'm your host, Alfred Dockery. Grab your hat and a lantern, and let's get on the trail. Today's episode is the Ashland Tragedy, Murder, Mayhem, and the Kentucky Militia. For Kentucky, it was the crime of the century. The 19th century. Three men committed a premeditated, brutal act of staggering evil. This is the story of missteps, red herrings, mob violence, political maneuvering, bad judgment, and eventual justice. I'm delighted to welcome Kevin McQueen, author of Murder in Old Kentucky, True Crime Stories from the Bluegrass, to the show to talk about the Ashland Tragedy. Professor McQueen, please introduce yourself.
Hello, good morning. I teach at Eastern Kentucky University in Richmond, Kentucky. I teach composition and also world literature. And I've written about 26 books covering true crime, history, biography, the paranormal, and a few other natural disasters and other things.
All right. For our listeners who aren't familiar with the Ashland tragedy, what happened on December 23rd, 1881 in Ashland, Kentucky?
Three men, George Ellscraft and William Neal, broke into the house of the Gibbons family just a couple days before Christmas Eve. They knew that the father had abandoned the family and the mother was out of town. And once they did get in, they murdered three teenagers in the house, two Gibbons children. They killed the disabled son outright with a hatchet or axe. And then they raped and murdered his sister, Fanny, and also a guest staying overnight named Emma Carrico. And after the murders occurred, they set the house on fire, obviously hoping people would just think the house caught fire, which happened all the time back then when chimneys went bad. And they thought that they would not be detected. Unfortunately for them, though, the house did not burn quickly enough, and neighbors managed to get inside and retrieve the bodies before they were too badly burned, and it was very obvious that they were actually murder victims.
Okay. Now, one of the things about this story is that, again, as we discussed before we started the record, we have multiple police officers, we have multiple suspects, we have multiple scenes, and we have multiple destinations. So I will be putting a Substack post together to a companion piece for people who would like to play along at home. But having said that, how did the initial investigations go, and who were our first suspects?
The first suspect was the father of the family, J.W. Gibbons, who frankly was not a bad suspect. He was emotionally in a bad place, I guess we would say today. He had abandoned his family. He was known to be very unstable. In fact, in the past, he had actually threatened to kill his family and burn the house down. Plus, the murders were occurred with a hatchet and a crowbar that were possessed by the family. But then later, he was able to prove that he had been in West Virginia for at least a week before the murders occurred, so he was very quickly dropped as a suspect once his alibi was established.
You know, there's a couple things here I want to highlight. Now, we are in Boyd County, which is in northeastern Kentucky, so you can basically step outside of the county into Ohio, or you could step out of the county into West Virginia. It's right there on the corner, and the Ohio River, of course, flows right in front of it. I also saw, I believe, in your chapter that they actually dragged a local pond looking for his body, thinking that he might have killed them and then committed suicide.
Yeah, he had actually in the past said that he was going to kill himself one day by jumping into a well. And one of the first things they did was examine the well, and there was no body in it. Pretty good clue.
Yeah. Okay, when did we get the big break in the case that actually led us to the culprits?
The big break came when Ellscraft, or George Ellis, I'm sorry. There's George Ellis and an Ellis Craft, and I get them mistaken quite often. George Ellis seemed to have been the weakling of the three, and he could not keep his mouth shut. He went to a local storekeeper just the day after New Year's, 1882, and he just said so many suspicious things. He said, paraphrasing, my wife and I and two others know more about this killing than anyone else. I hope they don't turn state's evidence against me. It's a little suspicious. The shopkeeper went to the police immediately. They arrested Ellis also immediately. And once in jail, he freely confessed. And the two men he named were his companions, Ellis Craft and William Neal.
Yeah, he, like the father, seemed to have some issues going on, but I don't think normal people commit crimes like this, so I suppose that is par for the course.
Oh, I agree. To do what happened to those poor teenagers, that takes a great mental disturbance.
Okay. Now, what did George Ellis claim happened on the night of the murders? What was his story?
The way he told it, he was asleep in bed, and then Neal and Craft, I guess, broke into his house or entered through the door or something and woke him up and said, would you like to have a little fun? And he told the story so many times, and he told it differently. The one thing that he always did consistently was he tried to make himself be in the very best light possible. And so the way he told it, he didn't want to go, but they aimed a gun in his face and he went with them. And he also claimed that when the murders and sexual assaulting was taking place, that he had no part of it. Later, he said, I don't know, maybe I held the girls down, but I didn't actually do anything more than that.
Yeah, I like to refer to that to the I just held the victim down defense, which I think actually there should be a special and greater sentence for anyone who utters those words. But that's just me being me. So his story changes over time. Initially, he names Craft and Neal. And so let's talk just a bit about how that story does shift from time to time.
First, he said that all three of them were in on it. And then he said that only, I'm trying to remember all the details because he told it so many times, so many different ways. Later, he said, I think Neal had nothing to do with it, but Craft did. Then later, I think he said Craft did, but Neal didn't. Later, it came out that Craft had some friends in the prison cell where he was being held, and it was thought that they were threatening him not to implicate Craft. Then much later on the witness stand, he recanted his recantation and said his first story was true after all.
Yeah, that was rather interesting life choices the fellow made there.
It shows a weak character. Yes. Even if his story is actually true, that he didn't really want to go along with them, but then later he just kept changing his story, no matter, depending on who he was talking to. That just shows not a very sterling and strong character, I think.
Yeah. Now, at one point he tried to implicate two unnamed black men. And there was also another attempt to claim that black men were involved. And I was curious what your take was on this narrative that got introduced.
As I recall, he blamed a couple, including a barber. Yes. And then later there was a detective from West Virginia who also claimed that blacks were responsible. And as far as the detective goes, he just kept embarrassing himself over and over. He presented jewelry and a breast pin that he said belonged to each of the two female victims, and their mothers both said not only did they not own the jewelry, they didn't own any jewelry. And one of them, who you were asking my take on that, it's not surprising. That was very common at the time. Excuse me. What was surprising, I thought, was that one of the named men, his name was Dyerly, actually sued the detective later for false arrest. And I've never been able to find out if the suit was successful. I'd really like to know, but I just thought it was interesting that he was legally capable of suing a detective who arrested him falsely.
Yeah. Now, if I'm not mistaken, that was Alf Burnett. And what's your read on him? Was he just really bad at being a detective, or did he have an agenda?
I'm not sure about an agenda. And frankly, I'm not even sure he was a bad detective, because since I wrote the book, I've been going through old newspapers and finding lots and lots of references to him. At least I think it's him. It's Alf Burnett from West Virginia, and he appears to have been a detective or a policeman at various stages. And some of the articles talked about how he was very good at solving crimes, but then we've got the Ashland tragedy, where he appears to just be a complete Inspector Clouseau, a complete incompetent. So I don't really know whether he was or not.
Okay. I understand. I'm actually somewhat relieved to know that he had a better track record than I had thought. So one of the unique points in this story is, because we are on the Ohio River, and because there were mobs chasing these guys at various stages, we have this riverboat chase involving the Bessie, the Mountain Girl, and the Mountain Boy. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
If I can only keep the details straight and what happened when, if I remember correctly, they were threatened by lynch mobs almost constantly, just about every single day. They were being threatened by mobs, and not just a few people. Some of the mobs allegedly numbered up to 1,500 people. So they were taken by train away from Ashland, I believe to Lexington, to go somewhere safe until they could be returned for their trial. Going by train wasn't very safe, because at one point the would-be lynchers tried to break up the train tracks. So it was decided it would be safer to take them by boat. And if I have it correct, they were loaded on a boat called the Mountain Girl, and they were just chugging their way up the Ohio, and the lynchers realized what was going on, so they commandeered a little smaller ship called Fanny. Was it Fanny?
Bessie, I believe.
I think it was Fanny. Okay. And I guess some of them knew how to drive a boat, and the boat was smaller and faster, and they almost caught up with Mountain Girl. But then at some point, while we were trying to board it like pirates, killers were transferred over to a faster ship called Mountain Boy. Oh, I remember. They went from the Fanny, they commandeered, got aboard the Mountain Girl. So it was a chase between Mountain Girl and Mountain Boy. But the boy outran and got them safely where they were supposed to be going.
Yeah, and these gentlemen, if I may use that word loosely, appeared to be the least popular people, I would think, in the country, and for obvious good reason. We have multiple trials, Neil, Kraft, and Ellis, and let's talk about how those worked out for them.
The first time, let's see, it was in January 1882. Neil was found guilty. He was tried first and sentenced to be hanged in 1 month. They really didn't fool around when it came to their hanging at the time. There was no no evidence that would be in favor. They did some very quick capital punishment. However, let me continue to the next one. Kraft also was found guilty, but their sentences were appealed. And they were appealed because Ellis had told so many stories over and over different. He would change his story so much, it was thought that it would be a lot fairer and a lot safer to give them a second trial. So that was what happened. Ellis himself was found guilty in 1882, and he was sentenced to life in prison rather than being hanged, because he had turned state's evidence against the other two. Didn't do him any good, though, because he ended up getting hanged by a lynch mob, I think, the very next day.
Yeah, and that triggered another series of events which really made this story even darker. Apparently, the governor of the state, Mr. Blackburn, took issue with this mob justice and was determined to prevent the same thing happening to the other two killers. And let's talk about his response. What did the governor do?
You're right. This was the event that really turned it into a national news story. Kentucky had always had a bad reputation for lynch mobs, and it was embarrassing to the state and embarrassing to the governor. In fact, it was embarrassing to the people of the region. They pointed out that most of the lynchers actually came from different counties or even from Ohio and West Virginia, but they were getting all the blame for it because it happened, on their territory. Governor Blackburn was determined that after Ellis was lynched, that Craft and Neal would have a fair trial and not be lynched, no matter what it took. And it was just an incredible. He called out, I wish I could remember how many, at different times, it seems like almost 8 or 9 state militias to guard these two prisoners. So that would have been about 100 soldiers or more guarding the two killers.
Yeah, it was at least 3 companies and some artillerymen. And I have found accounts that put the number as high as 300 men.
I wouldn't be surprised, depending on how many people there were in the units, but it was just an incredible number of men out to protect. The governor was definitely determined. He was not going to let Kentucky be made fun of and become an example again.
Yeah, there's one point where I believe he said that these men were going to be received justice through the court system, even if it caused the death of everyone in Boyd County, which I am not a politician, but it seems like there might have been a better way to phrase that.
That's a good way to lose the Boyd County vote right there.
One would think, I don't know, maybe he was term limited, but regardless, he was definitely adamant on this issue. And I believe that some people even nicknamed the militia Blackburn's Army.
They did. And the Boyd Countyans were saying it happened in Boyd County, but it was people from other counties and states who did all the hanging. Which is very possible. I don't know. They weren't checking IDs, I'm sure.
This sounds like the sort of crime that would bring people in from any reasonable area. And again, they are right there on the corner of the state. So it would have been no big deal for mobs to come in from West Virginia, from Ohio, and certainly from other counties in Kentucky.
I pointed out in the book that this was a region populated, first of all, by riverboatmen, also by mountaineers, and also iron mill workers, all very tough men with an almost zero tolerance for crimes against women and children. So I think it would have been actually more amazing if there had not been a lynch mob.
Okay. Agreed. Now, that brings us to the Granite State and an incident involving a ferry boat and a crowd of onlookers. Let's talk about what happened there.
This was another thing that made it national news in a very bad way, but in a slightly good way, too. What happened was the killers, the two remaining ones, that is, were taken aboard a ship called the Granite State to be sailed up the Ohio to a safe place awaiting trial. And a mob had warned they were going to try to get aboard, take shots at the ship, whatever it took. So you had a few men, probably more than a few, ready to start shooting at the ship, hoping to board it, hoping to, if they could see the two killers, just be snipers and get them. There was also a crowd of onlookers and bystanders who did something pretty foolish. They got much, much too close to the action. So when the mob started shooting at the ship, they were given orders to shoot back. And the result was they killed 2 of the men in the mob, but also 4 innocent bystanders. It was a very bad moment for the state because innocent people had been killed, but at the same time, it showed how serious the state had become about trying to protect the 2 men from being lynched.
Yes, and I have 2 kind of quick observations about this that I wanted to put forth. I was trying to ascertain what sort of weapons they would have been armed with. And at that point in time, the U.S. Army had gone to the trapdoor Springfield, which shot a 45-70 government round propelled by 70 grains of black powder. And the projectile on that thing was like 450 grains. To give you some context, modern rifles, big bullet is 180 grains. And so that's more than double in size. And consequently, it had something of a rainbow trajectory. There was a lot of guesstimation on as far as elevation, which might account for why some of the rounds went so far afield. But yeah, you wouldn't want to be hit by one of those.
No, I'm glad you researched that because I really did not know that. Yeah. And gosh, it makes you wonder that anyone in the crowd even survived.
And we're still in black powder days. Smokeless powder really wouldn't show up until around 1900. So when they did fire off that volley, and if they loaded the next round, they were essentially blind at that point because they were in a cloud of smoke. Yeah, it was not a good time for mass volleys anywhere near crowds.
See, I didn't think of that, but that's very true. It would have been very smoky, almost foggy, and very hard to see. So the newspapers at the time, some of them were praising the governor for taking the lynch threatening seriously. Others were complaining, why were they shooting with all those bystanders so close? So you can make a case for either side, really.
Yeah, you can definitely see both points of view, and you have to feel a little bit for the people in Boyd County because they really were in the middle of this thing and there was just no way out.
That's true.
Okay. Neal and Kraft were given a second trial due to the testimony of Ellis. And how did those second trials work out for them?
Both of them were found guilty of murder and sentenced to be hanged. So they had the one appeal, and if I'm not mistaken, the one appeal was all they got.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way it usually goes. You get one, and then whatever happens in the second trial happens to you. Okay, so
unless you get commuted or the governor, commutes your sentence to life in prison.
Yeah.
Which these guys weren't about to get life in prison, considering what they were accused of.
No, I think in reality, the only real possible verdict was to hang them. Because if they didn't hang them, they would either be dragged from prison and lynched, or people in prison would have murdered them. And that either way, it would have been a non-judicial execution, which was exactly what the governor was trying to avoid.
Something bad was going to happen no matter what.
Okay. Now, what would you say is the legacy of this rather? Oh, one other quick aside before I forget again. One of the things I find interesting about this case is that this is, I think, the only case I've come across where more people died after the crime than died during the crime. It was rather unusual.
Right. Yeah, one man lynched, two bystanders. No, in the mob were shot and four bystanders killed. So that makes four, five, six, about seven people who died other than the victims and also the two other killers.
Okay. So what would you say is the legacy of the Ashland tragedy?
The legacy at the time was it showed that the state could be very serious dealing with lynch mobs. Now, I do have records of lynchings taking place for many years after. They weren't always easy to prevent because obviously they were done quickly and secretly, and often they were over with before anyone even knew about it. In the case of the Ashland tragedy, the lynchers made no bones about what they were going to try to do. When you see 1,000, 2,000 men gathering, you know they're going to do something or try to do something. That was the legacy at the time. It didn't always work, but it showed that the state was serious about trying to uphold the law. The legacy today is just, I think that it's possibly the most famous crime in Kentucky history. It still gets discussed a lot. There are websites devoted to it. And it just turns up very often in discussions about Kentucky history or Kentucky crime or both.
Now, part of that legacy is in the form of ballads, and I noticed that you were able to uncover at least two ballads that were chronicled the case. There was one by Elijah Adams, The Ashland Tragedy, and then one by Bill Terrell, which is sometimes titled The Murder of the Gibbons Children. What's your take on the ballads? Would you say that they reasonably match the history of the event?
I should point out first, this was definitely not unusual. Almost any high-profile crime that became noted, someone would end up writing a song about it. They're called murder ballads. There are many books, in fact, devoted to murder ballads. And I'm sorry to say that I've never actually heard these two songs, but I have seen the lyrics printed. And mostly they're pretty accurate. It's surprising most murder ballads are. I think they were literally getting their information from the newspapers. The major difference between them is one seems to be, oh gosh, I don't know, maybe a little more pro-lynching than the other.
Yeah, I agree. Now, reading them, I have to say I thought they were both quite good. I thought Terrell's was slightly better. I don't have any concept of what the tune would be, and I probably am not the best person to adjudicate the merits of various songwriters. We'll just leave that there.
I'd like to hear them, and I'd been hoping that perhaps I could find them on YouTube, but I wasn't able to, or maybe I just wasn't looking.
No, I did
long enough. I can't play any instruments, but if you find them in songbooks, you'll find the chords and the tabs, and if you know how to play a guitar, you can actually play along and you'll get the melody. But so many folk songs and ballads shared melodies. They would just keep readapting the lyrics to the same tune, so I wouldn't be surprised if we actually know the melodies anyway.
Yeah. And you're quite correct. There are a lot of Appalachian murder ballads. Frankie Silver, Tom Dooley, Knoxville Girl, Omi Wise. It is a long and exhaustive list. And often they were printed as, if they weren't recorded, they were printed as broadsides, almost like
broadside
ballads. Yeah.
And you could buy them, I don't know, a penny a sheet off the street. I don't know if they actually came with the chords. Maybe they did.
Yeah. Now, A while back, I interviewed Professor Kevin Young about the murder of Gladys Kincaid in Morganton, North Carolina in 1927. And they actually printed up broadsheets and sold them, like you said, I think for a penny or a nickel each. And some people still have them. So, yeah.
I wonder when they stopped doing that, because I know they were doing this at least well into the 1920s and 30s.
I really think it changed. The change came somewhat after, like in the 1930s or 40s, after the recording industry really got up and running. For whatever reason, they just became out of fashion, but they go back quite a ways. And if you leave the shores of the United States, you'll find them in England and other places going back hundreds of years.
There are probably collections of them.
Oh, yeah.
Like on CD or something. I would be very surprised if there weren't one.
Yeah, they're collected in various places, mostly by the people who were going around in the 20s and 30s and just documenting what ballads existed in Appalachia at that time. All right. Okay, anywhere I can send people to see your work, of course, the book is available on Amazon.
Ooh, you can find almost all my books on Amazon or straight from the publishers. Most of them have been published by, for example, if you go to the websites for Indiana University, you'll find some. Also, especially Arcadia Publishing, aka History Press, I've done about half my books. America Through Time did my last one. Pelican Publishing in Louisiana did a couple. So various publishers, but I think almost all of them are on Amazon. And you can also, if you want to, follow me on Facebook. I have a website, kevinmcqueenstories.com. One thing I would like to advise, though, is remember my name is spelled K-E-V-E-N. So if you have my name spelling correct, you'll probably find my Facebook and my web page a lot easier.
Understood. All right, we'll leave it there. Again, I will be putting together a companion piece on the Blue Ridge True Crime Substack for folks who want to see some maps and images and get a little bit of better idea of the geography of the crime. And until next time, I'll look for you on the back roads. That's it for this episode of the Blue Ridge True Crime Podcast. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps more people find the show. Check the show notes for links to the Blue Ridge True Crime Substack and YouTube channel, and any story-related links. Until next time, I'll look for you on the back roads.